Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober. My podcast and blog focus on informing consumers about the most sustainable products out there for all types of food, both animals and plants. As meat, especially beef, is my favorite, I devote a major portion of my blog to beef, as it's the most demonized food. Plus, I love a good, sustainably sourced grass-fed beef. Today, I'm joined by somebody with a similar mission. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman is an environmental lawyer, rancher, and author. In 2014, she released the groundbreaking book Defending Beef, which blew the lid off all of the myths surrounding the environmental and health claims against beef. Just recently, she released the second edition of the book with updated information. Nicolette, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I love that introduction. That's awesome.
Oh, that means a lot to me that you say you love it, because you're one of the people that's really informed a lot of what I know and what I talk about on the show in terms of regenerative agriculture. Your book was definitely one of the most eye-opening things I've read.
Oh, thank you. That's always so good to hear. I mean, that's what we're in this for, right?
Right.
Is to try. I mean, you know, we're going to talk about this, I'm sure, but my background is all, you know, I was trained as a scientist, as a biologist, and then as a lawyer. And my whole mission, I feel like, is to just inform people and get people, you know, looking at issues in a deeper way. And so, you know, it's a thrill to be talking to you, because I think that's where we're heading today.
Oh, yeah. You can tell by the names of what we're known for that we're on very much the same page. Appropriate Omnivore, Defending Beef.
Exactly.
Before we get into your book and the recent second edition of it, tell the listeners a little more about what you do.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, I was a kid who grew up in Michigan and really spent a lot of time outside. And my parents were really interested in food and health already. Like, that was how I was always raised, this idea that you want to try to eat the healthiest possible food and, you know, be very physically active and be outside. So that was always something I did and was interested in. And I majored in biology in college and was very interested in environmental issues and environmental causes. And partly because of that interest, I decided to become a vegetarian as a freshman in college, because I sort of believed that was the right thing to do if you cared about the environment and also if you cared about your health. You know, there was all this focus on saturated fat and the deforestation of the Amazon, you know, on the environmental side. And I became a vegetarian at that time. And then I, you know, went to law school and I was working as an attorney for a while, prosecuting attorney and in a firm for a while. But then I started working for environmental groups. And eventually I was hired by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be the senior attorney for the group Waterkeeper Alliance. And he's the one that really got me started on this whole focus on the meat industry, because there was a tremendous amount of his work was focused on water pollution from large concentrated hog and poultry operations, especially in North Carolina and a few other areas of the country, Missouri and a few other places that really had a lot of, you know, big concentrated, basically industrial animal facilities. And he started me working on that question, and I just realized this was an enormous issue. You know, the way animals were being raised was affecting the environment and obviously animal welfare and food quality and human health in a lot of different ways in terms of air pollution, water pollution, et cetera. But there wasn't really any attention being paid to this at that time. You know, that was 20 years ago. And, you know, major environmental groups and so forth were not addressing this issue, and neither was the government or anything like that. So that became my focus. And then I did that work for 2 years, and I left that job and ended up marrying. Through that work, I came to know a lot of really good farmers that were doing essentially regenerative practices on their farms. And I met the founder of the Nyman Ranch Network of farmers, Bill Nyman, and we ended up getting married, and I moved from New York to California. And I was still, you know, a vegetarian environmental lawyer, so the union was surprising to some people. But then I moved to our ranch, and I actually started working on our ranch, not intentionally at first, but just kind of helping out a little bit here and there. But I was really interested in you know, what we were doing and how we were doing it. And I ended up working pretty much full time on the ranch for about 7 years. And during that time, I wrote my first book, Righteous Pork Chop, which is really about, you know, kind of explaining the way meat production had become industrialized and what was wrong with that, you know, for the environment and humans and animals. And I also started making the case in that book for the value and importance of animals in the food system and in the human diet. So that was my first book. Then I wrote, as you mentioned, the first edition of the Defending Beef book, because I realized that there was a kind of an inordinate amount of attention being paid and just a tremendous amount of inaccuracy surrounding the discussion about beef and its role in, you know, climate change and everything else. So I wrote that book, and just about a year and a half ago, the publisher approached me and said, you know, this book is more timely than ever. Can you get a new edition put together? And I thought, oh, sure, I can do that in a couple months. I'll just, you know, update the studies and so forth. But I started going through it very carefully, you know, page by page, paragraph by paragraph. And I realized there was actually a lot that I wanted to change about the book. Not that I disagree with the original version, but I just had my thinking has evolved a lot since then. So I spent over a year rewriting it, and the book is really a whole new book with a lot of additional focus on, you know, some of the specific issues like methane and so forth. But also, I've really shifted the focus towards processed foods, you know, and industrial production on the farming side. So I, you know, rather than a dichotomous, you know, discussion of meat versus no meat, which is still, you know, important to discuss that comparison, but I'm increasingly persuaded the real problem we're having in this country is basically industrialization in the food system, and both on the farm side and on the diet side. So that's what the new book is doing, is it's really making the case for meat as an incredibly nutrient-rich, real food, you know, that is the opposite of the kinds of foods that are causing problems in human health. So I felt really excited to have this new book come out, because it's really what I think, you know, what I want to be saying right now.
I agree, because I feel like when people are really attacking beef, what they are is they're very much attacking industrialized beef, and they're leaving out the part that when it's not industrialized, when it's truly from a sustainable family farm, that there actually are a lot of environmental and health advantages to it. So I like that you went that direction. The book really does a great job of touching on all of the points of why beef is good and really explaining the difference between industrialized factory farm beef and beef that comes from these cows that are living on the pasture their entire life. So why do you believe cattle are essential to the world's food system?
Well, the most important point that people need to understand is that of the land surface that the earth has, almost half of that land, according to Dr. Lynn Hunsinger from Berkeley, the biology department, rangeland scientist, she says almost half of the world's land is actually non-farmable land. So it's either, you know, too hilly, too rocky, too arid, too dry. You know, there's just all kinds of reasons why you can't really raise crops on a huge portion of the land surface. And actually, the ranch that I live on in Northern California would fall into this category, almost all of it. There's a few portions of it, you know, a few acres where you could raise a little bit of crops. But basically, when you have areas where there's, you know, either mountains or hills or cliffs or, you know, a lot of rocks, it's very difficult to raise food crops. And in fact, where we live, part of the problem is it's very windy and it's cool. And the only time we get moisture in this part of the world is during the winter. So, you know, it's like during the coldest time of year. And then, and that's why, you know, that's why you have such a huge problem with wildfires in California, because, you know, we have that really long dry season. So where we live, it would be almost impossible to raise crops. But what we do have here is really good conditions for grass. And of course, grass and other, you know, types of vegetation, but primarily grass, is just a naturally occurring vegetation that is simply, you know, watered by the rain and is powered by the sun. And it's a really, really important part of the earth, because it is protecting all the soils that are beneath the grass. You know, the more vegetation that you have, the more protected the soils are. and the more diverse the vegetation is. You know, this is a really important part that rarely gets discussed, but if you have greater diversity of the vegetation, you will have a much more diverse, you know, sort of upstream ecosystem effects, everything from the insect life all the way up to the, you know, the macro fauna, you know, the megafauna, every size of animal. There's more diversity in the whole ecosystem when you have a more diverse vegetative cover and more diverse soil life is the sort of the origin of that more diverse vegetation. Well, the way the earth created these grassy areas and maintained it was co-evolving with these grazing animals. And there were once enormous herds of lots of different types of grazing animals on the earth. And almost all of those wild herds have disappeared, you know, some of it due to just major shifts in climate, you know, thousands of years ago, and some of it due to human hunting, you know, and there are lots of different things that have changed it. But what has happened is humans have replaced a lot of those missing, you know, disappeared wild animals with domesticated grazing herds. And they fill that ecological niche of grazing on that vegetation. And by doing that, maintaining the life of those plants and of the soil beneath the plants, and essentially maintaining the existence of these open areas that the world has, you know, that has have been there for millions of years. So I view, you know, the grazing animals as an absolutely essential part of sort of the way the earth functions. And I think they're an absolutely essential part of the food system, because that enormous portion of the world's surface that is not farmable, a lot of that is ideal grazing land. And any rangeland scientist will tell you that the vast majority of the grazing animals on the earth are in those areas. You know, they're precisely in those large open grassy areas that really cannot or should not be farmed. And so you're sort of using the earth's ecosystems appropriately when you have the grazing animals. And then they produce incredibly nutrient-rich food. So obviously meat and also milk. And those food products, you know, the thing that almost never gets discussed is they're so valuable to the human body that if you take them away, you would have to replace them with other foods that are very, you know, energy intensive and environmentally intensive to produce. And, you know, there's all kinds of discussion in, you know, especially in advocacy literature about this idea that meat is inefficient to produce. But that's a really short-sighted understanding of how, you know, how agriculture really works, because especially these grazing animals are actually using land that really can't be used for farming, and they're converting inedible vegetation, you know, inedible to humans, but also to most other animals, into meat and milk. So they're playing an incredibly important role that really cannot be fulfilled by anything other than the grazing animals. So that's why I consider them an absolutely essential part of an ecologically sound food system. And also, they play a really important role when they're, especially when they're well managed. A lot of the grazing in the world is not being done very well and could be improved. Even poorly managed grazing is probably ecologically better than a lot of types of crop production. But when you have well-managed grazing, which more and more of the earth's grazing is moving toward this because there's so much interest in this nowadays. But when you have well-managed grazing, you actually have tremendous ecological services, eco-services they call it, or ecological benefits that happen in those regions, because the vegetative cover is, by virtue of the grazing, is cropped and pruned, which allows more regrowth and more diversity of the vegetation. And you have the reintroduction of nutrients, or the cycling of nutrients that is sped up by the presence of the grazing animals with their urine and manure and all of their, you know, impacts, their hooves and their mouths and their digestive tracts. All of this leads to more biological life in the soils. And that is the key to ecosystem health, partly because it creates this more diverse soil, like I was talking about a few moments ago, and also because there's a tremendous amount of evidence showing that good grazing leads to a great deal more water being retained in the soil. And so the whole ecosystem is more, you know, it's healthier and less dry, you know, it's more hydrated, and there's more moisture in that ecosystem. And so it's ironic to me that there's so much discussion about the negative, supposedly negative effects of grazing animals, because they actually, when well managed, they have tremendous positive ecological effects.
Yes, and I think that a very important part you bring up in the book is the misconception of grazing with that term overgrazing, and I love how you explain the difference between overgrazing and how it's actually not that common, and what they're typically talking about is inefficient grazing.
Yeah, I really have to credit Alan Savory with this idea. He's, of course, a wildlife biologist from Africa and from Zimbabwe, and he talks about the fact that it's really basically poorly managed grazing. It's not overgrazing. In fact, he says it's often undergrazing. And he learned this when he was working in Africa and was seeing, he was actually a wildlife ecologist for the government, and they were removing animals, wild animals as well as domesticated animals, from areas that were becoming desertified. And what he saw repeatedly in his work was that when they would remove large animals, the system would actually deteriorate more. And he began, from that experience, that firsthand observation of this, he began to investigate the notion that the grazing animal was actually performing an incredibly important, you know, role in keeping the system alive. And he's shown his work at the Savory Institute and people that are following his teachings around the world, they've shown that they can create a great deal more systems with a great deal more water by adding grazing animals to areas. So it's really kind of flips the whole argument on its head. And he says the grazing that you see that's done badly around the world primarily is not about overgrazing. It's about grazing that isn't done in a managed and controlled way. Because what he's really been teaching people for decades is that you need to try to create the impact on the earth that a wild herd would have had. And so ideas like having the animals more densely congregated, having them move off of the land, because Savory points out that the resting phase is really important to the whole, you know, ecosystem and the way the planet is supposed to function. And so their whole idea is think holistically about the system and understand, you know, how the water courses are supposed to be working, how the soils are supposed to be working, what the wildlife would have been doing here, you know, over the geological time that, you know, the earth has existed, and try to recreate that kind of a system on your farm or ranch. And people that are doing this around the world are seeing enormous restoration of eroded landscapes. And in particular, there are a lot of places that are adding animals back into places that were crop farming, that was really severely degenerated based on crop production, because crop production is very extractive generally. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, it can be done much better as well. But there has been a tremendous amount of very damaging plowing and planting and harvesting of the earth. And when you add animals back into those systems, you often see a tremendous reinvigoration of the whole biological, you know, engine of the system. And again, the water gets reintroduced in the system that way. So it's amazing to me, because the more I've learned about this over the last 20 years, the more I've realized that the mainstream conversation is just really off base. So that's what I'm trying to get some of these ideas, you know, reexamined.
Yes, and earlier you were talking about the benefits that cattle have to the soil, and there's definitely a growing focus on soils for the world food system. There's the emergence of the study of soil science. What is the discussion around soils, and what role do cattle play in it?
Yeah, well, it's not, you know, it's interesting. It's not fully understood. I mean, there are, you know, just talking about Alan Savory's work, and there are people all around the world that have shown that when you have grazing animals, it sort of triggers the biological activity of the whole system. And, you know, there's a lot of research looking into why that is. And, you know, you'd think these questions are very simple to answer, but they're not. I mean, this whole existence, there's something called glomalin or glomalin that was just discovered by USDA soil scientists within the last couple of decades. And that's actually probably one of the most important discoveries in soil science, because glomalin is a substance that coats the plant roots in any system. And where you have a living growing plant, the glomalin actually fosters the exchanges that happen between the soil and the plant. So the plant is taking the energy of the sun and brings carbon into its roots and exchanges that carbon with the soils for nutrition that it needs. You know, basically things like nitrogen, for example. And this is all happening on the microscopic level, largely through certain types of fungi that are tiny little, you know, there's this tiny little economic activity going down their exchanges. And the glomalin is just a substance that is on the plant roots that actually fosters these exchanges. It makes it possible for these two substances to be, or two, or, you know, many substances to be exchanged. No one even knew about the existence of the glomalin until, you know, recent years. So there's a lot of really interesting emerging science that is showing, you know, what's actually happening down in the soils and why these things all matter. And one of the things that's been discovered is that if you put, for example, commercial fertilizers on land, it actually diminishes the presence of the glomalin on the roots of the plants. And the speculation that soil scientists have believe what's happening is that the plant essentially becomes kind of lazy. It doesn't need to engage in as much of these exchanges in order to grow. And so the glomalin basically begins to disappear, and the whole, all of these exchanges between plant and soil begin to disappear as well. And so when you have animals in a system instead of commercial fertilizer, because animal, you know, the presence of animals and just adding the compost from animals or their dung or whatever, you can use animals in a lot of different ways on a farm for fertility. But that actually has been shown to benefit this whole system of below ground exchanges between the plant and the soil. So it seems like it would be really easy and obvious to explain, well, here's why you need animals in a food system. But actually, some of this stuff is very recently being understood in the scientific world. But whatever the specific explanations are, there's tremendous evidence from around the world showing that you get more biological life in the soil, you get more diversity of organisms, more organisms altogether, and then more diversity of the vegetation of the soil and above the soils, and then from that again, more diversity of insect life. And you have people like Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, who's an entomologist and soil scientist that used to be with the USDA, and his whole argument that he's kind of making now publicly is that we've been focusing, agriculture has been focusing on eliminating insects for so long, and actually the vast majority of the insects are absolutely essential to ecosystems and to the world's food system. And he argues that whenever you have too much of one insect, it means the system is really out of balance. You know, so all of these questions of, you know, we're now beginning to understand as humans for the first time that we need to think about food systems like natural systems, you know, like ecosystems. And when you look at it from that perspective, like, you know, like Dr. Lundgren's work on the insect diversity and the importance of that for healthy food production, then you start to have a whole different lens. And then you start understanding the value of animals and the absolutely essential nature of them, because no natural system functions without animals. Everything in animals is a three-part system. It's fungi and it's plant and it's animal. And everything is about the interconnectedness of those three components. So the animal, you know, for some reasons that are understood and for a lot of reasons that are not understood yet, is a really important part of creating a truly regenerative food system.
When I first read Defending Beef, the part about glomalin was very much an aha moment, because I actually never heard of the term. And I'm actually kind of surprised we don't hear more about that, because it very much is, I saw as very much not just explains the whole soil science and photosynthesis, but really also what connects then how cattle play a role in all of the soil science.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, you know, so many of these issues are very difficult to explain and to make interesting to people that are busy and they're, you know, they're just trying to figure out what to buy at the grocery store or whatever, or what should I eat, you know, to be, you know, slim and fit and whatever. And so getting into these nitty gritty, unfortunately, it's not something that most people want to spend time. And I think, unfortunately, there's so much focus now, you know, in sort of coming up with headlines that people want to click on, you know, and or just having quick little sound bites in news stories, that it's just not, you know, sadly kind of sexy enough. But yeah, I had the same feeling when I did the research. When I started writing the first Defending Beef book, I sort of thought I knew what I was going to say in it. And then the more research I did, I found out a lot of fascinating things that I didn't know about. And glomalin was one of those things. So it was a big aha moment for me as well. And it's a very important, you know, kind of like grease that powers the engine of the ecosystem. And also connected with that, there's that whole role of fungi. You know, the mycelium is this massive below ground network of fungi that's kind of all over the world. And there's been, you know, that German ecologist Peter Wohlleben, who's written the books about trees and, you know, the secret life of trees and all this so forth. And he's written extensively about that underground network among trees, but it's also all over, you know, in the plant world. And that mycelium, that interconnected sort of below ground lattice of, you know, fungal hyphae, essentially, is absolutely another essential component for understanding sort of how ecosystems work. And it's another thing that's rarely talked about or written about. And I didn't know very much about it myself either until I started doing the research for the book. But it's a large part of the reason why, again, why grazing animals are so important, because the mycelium gets disrupted dramatically, pretty much destroyed whenever you have plowing. And that's why the grazing animals are so important, because they can actually, you know, they're powered on land that is not plowed. And so having that sort of protected vegetative surface and then having that below ground environment where you have all these, you know, this interconnected set of fungal roots, that's a really important part of having sustainable ecosystems. And again, in woods, you know, in forest environments, for example, it's been shown that that mycelium is extraordinary, you know, in terms of the amount of it and the distance that it covers. And that is kind of how everything happens in an ecosystem. Yet again, no one's talking about that when they're talking about sustainable food. But when we have grazing animals, we can actually support that mycelium and all of the benefits that it brings to the ecosystem.
So we've talked about a lot of the different charges against beef in terms of grazing and land use. And another claim people often make against meat, especially beef, is methane, which are emitted from cattle. And yeah, a lot of people consider it a serious greenhouse gas. So what would you say in regards to that?
Yeah, well, I think it's been fascinating to me how much focus there's been on methane, because I've realized, you know, again, we're kind of in this era where information is transmitted in quick sound bites. And it's been kind of an effective little soundbite for people that are opposing meat. And I actually saw this really interesting lecture by Jeremy Rifkin, who wrote the book Beyond Beef, you know, like 25 or 30 years ago now, or whenever that was. It's been around for quite a while. And he was arguing at this animal rights conference at Harvard. You know, he said, the meat is murder argument hasn't really worked. You guys got to come up with some new tools. And I would argue you focus on climate change, you know, as your primary argument against meat. And I thought that was just a fascinating thing to discover when I saw that video, because I realized, like, wow, I kind of knew this was happening, but to see this explicitly stated was pretty amazing. So what has happened with climate change is, you know, there's obviously a lot of talk about carbon dioxide, but when it comes to beef and meat in general, but especially beef, there's particularly a focus on methane, because the ruminant animals do emit methane in their digestion. And so that's a simple thing you can grab onto, and you can say, oh, methane is, you know, 23 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, and there's all this methane from beef, therefore, you know, A, B, C, you know, this leads to this. You know, clearly, we must get rid of beef. You know, so again, kind of ignoring all these complex, you know, ecosystem questions we've been talking about. But when I wrote the first edition of Defending Beef, I wrote about methane and described some of the, you know, complexity that wasn't being discussed. For example, soil health. The more health you have in the soil, the more diverse and biologically alive soil that, like we've been talking about, the more organisms you have, microorganisms you have that actually consume methane. So there's really good research from a number of different universities showing that a healthier grazing system will have a significantly lower methane emission, because the soil organisms will actually consume the methane. And actually, termites do this exact thing. Termites are like little tiny cattle, you know. They have these digestive tracts that are inhabited by microorganisms. And the way cattle can eat grass, which is just basically cellulosic vegetation that other animals can't really survive on, cattle are able to digest that because they have all these microorganisms that reside in their complex digestive tracts. And termites on a little tiny, miniature scale are the same way. They can eat wood, which is basically just cellulose that most animals can't survive on. And they can live off of that because the microorganisms in the termite gut actually break it down for them. And then they emit methane, just like cattle do, on a smaller scale, little tiny methane emitters. But what was really interesting is some of the research on termite mounds have found that the total emission from a termite mound is pretty close to zero because there are so many methane oxidizing bacteria that reside in that termite mound with the termites that they actually consume all the methane. I mean, this is what's so amazing about nature. Whenever there's a kind of something produced by nature, there's something else that evolved to consume it, right?
Right.
All the niches get filled. And this was true for the grazing animals on the world surface. There was this evolution of methane oxidizing bacteria in the ecosystems where the grazing animals existed. But there's also a tremendous amount of new research around methane that I've now included. The methane discussion is really expanded in the new book because, for example, this whole question of how methane is discussed and treated in policy discussions, I talk about it a lot because Dr. Miles Allen from Oxford University, who's a physicist who's an expert in methane, has demonstrated that the current way of treating methane in public policy circles, which is basically to equate CO2 and methane, and to basically say, well, this is just the same thing, except for 23 times more powerful or whatever, is actually nonsense in the real world, because they have a system for measuring it called GWP, global warming potential. And he's shown that CO2, I mean, this is actually well known among all the scientists, but he's arguing they need to change the way it's being treated in public policy circles. GWP just basically says there's this much CO2 equals this much methane. And what Dr. Allen has shown is that in the real world, because CO2 is essentially lasts forever, it lasts over 100,000 years, it builds up in the atmosphere. And that's why, there's so much discussion about this. Whenever you have an emission from a car or a factory or any place, there's more CO2 in the atmosphere. That is not at all the way methane functions. Methane only lives for about 10 years in the environment. It gets broken down by, the bacteria we've been talking about and lots of other ways that it gets broken down. And it's basically just cycling back into the natural environment. And he says there's this historic load of methane on the earth, and it's been there because, we had the ruminant grazing animals for millions of years. And the only way that you're actually increasing warming with things like cattle is to increase the total cattle herd. Now, in the U.S., for example, we've actually been decreasing the cattle herd for a long time. And there's all kinds of other evidence from the U.S. and around the world that where we have cattle herds, it does not correspond at all with where we have large methane emissions. And the professor at Cornell University, who's their lead methane expert, Dr. Robert Howarth, has shown that the satellite data does not support the argument that the methane emissions, the primary methane sources in the U.S. are from cattle at all. It's really from fracking and other fossil fuel sources. So I go through a lot of this in a great detail in the book. But the sort of bottom line of all of this is that the methane issue has been really oversimplified and misunderstood. And that actually, like with so many other things, it's really kind of a red herring when you talk about methane from the domesticated grazing animals, because they're really cycling carbon through their digestive tracts. And just as, peat bogs do and, swamps and rice production, there is methane that's released in that process. But the vast majority of it is quickly broken down. And there's no evidence at all that the cattle herd is actually increasing global warming. And that's kind of the bottom line. So I think, with everything else, as with all of these issues, they're far more complex than people typically want to appreciate. And if we focus on improving grazing practices, it has a tremendous advantage. It helps with all of these issues, whether we're talking about water or soil or climate emissions, because there's actually really good evidence that's from, you know, just from the last few years as well, showing that there's actually so much carbon sequestration that happens in the soils where you have good grazing that it actually more than fully offsets all of the global warming gases that come from cattle production, including the methane. So if we improve the way we're raising cattle, you know, it's, I always say it's not the cow, it's the how.
Yes.
You know, we can actually have, I mean, there's a wonderful farm in Bluffton, Georgia, my friend Will Harris's farm, the White Oak Pastures farm,
yes,
where they actually
amazing
have done
farm.
Some. Yeah. Have you been there? It's an incredible place.
I haven't, but I've met people from the farm at the Wise Traditions Conference and other conventions, and I do hope to visit it soon.
Yeah, you should, because they're, I mean, it's such a beautiful place, and really any of your listeners should try to get there if they can. I'm sure they welcome visitors because they have, I know they have cottages where you can stay and things like that. But there, it's an amazing place because Will Harris took essentially, you know, kind of a commodity, really oversimplified monocrop type farm and started recreating, you know, complexity to the system, to the agricultural system and to the economic system of it. They started producing all different kinds of products. He built his own slaughterhouse so that he could just, you know, slaughter his animals right on site, and added in all different kinds of species, you know, not just cattle, but goats and chickens and all kinds of other things. And he kind of recreated ecological complexity. But they did this very thorough audit, not they, but they hired a third party to do this. They did a thorough audit of everything they were producing on their farm, and they actually found that the most carbon beneficial was the beef, that the beef was actually sequestering more carbon in the soil than all of the carbon that went into its production. And that was not true from the other foods that they were producing, you know, the vegetables and everything else. They were good in all categories, but they were the only one where it's actually sequestering more than it was emitting was the beef. So I think, you know, this is the key message with all of this is, first of all, far more complexity than people, you know, think there is to it. But also when things are done well, animals are really valuable to the ecological health of the system.
Yes. Like you say, a lot of this is oversimplified. There's many different aspects to look at it, and your book does a great job of covering really all the aspects. So I think one of the most interesting is you have a chapter called People, which argues that cattle enable more people to live and work on the land.
Yeah.
Explain why this is important.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I first wrote the book, I almost hesitated to put that chapter in there because it didn't seem to neatly fit into the ecological argument or the health argument. But I really wanted to say it because it was something I'd been thinking about for a long time, because I've visited farms and ranches around the world, and a lot of them in the United States. And I've many of them are in very, you know, sort of isolated areas that essentially would be almost uninhabitable by humans if there were not some profession. I mean, they don't have internet, but even long, you know, long before the internet age, you know, there was basically nothing economically going on in these places. And there's not, in many cases, there's no way to even farm on these places because they're very, like we've been talking about before, they're essentially that land that's too dry or too windy or cool or whatever, not enough moisture, you know, to raise crops. But they can raise the grazing animals on these areas. And that's what enables the people to live on these places. But also, I've been in a lot of farms around the world where it's a diversified farm, but the animals provide the most valuable component of the farm economy. So it just really clicked in my mind that animals were making farming possible for so many people that are in agriculture, and that the life that you have when you live on a farm is something that I think is so unique and valuable that it's something that we should be interested in protecting as a society. You know, so I sort of make the case for, and I talk about our own family and how I think my two boys that are now age 8 and 12 have had this unbelievably wonderful upbringing here because they've been able to be out. And it's really been clear during the, you know, the pandemic time, because so many people are essentially locked in apartments. And I really feel badly for children in that situation in particular.
Yes, me too.
But our kids, you know, yeah, our kids were out there and, you know, not just like running around and roaming around and, you know, exploring and climbing trees and swimming in our pond and doing all the stuff that, you know, they always did. But they were involved in everything that makes them really strong environmentalists. You know, they love to observe nature and be part of nature. And everything from, we have, for example, a pet Canada goose, because there was an abandoned gosling on our ranch. And we left it out there for a couple days, hoping it would get reunited with its parents. And after it, a couple of its siblings got, predators got to them, we thought, well, we got to help this guy, you know. So we took him in, and he lives in our deck. He lives in our yard and has a place where he goes in at night, you know. But they have this amazing opportunity to interact with our animals that we raise for food, but also all of the wild animals, all the insects and the worms and the lizards and the snakes every single day. That's their daily life. And because of that, they're both passionate environmentalists. You know, they care so much about the natural world and protecting it and the health of it and understanding, you know, the human connection to that. And I'm so happy that they've been able to have that. And I'm so sorry that that is not something that more kids get to have. So I argue in the book that protecting that environment for, you know, family life, for human existence, is a really important part of the, you know, the role of animals in the food system as well.
It is a very important part. And it reminds me of how I remember about a year ago, Joel Salatin was talking about during the pandemic about the benefits of coming to his farm and getting to witness nature and the soil.
Yeah. Well, every time we've had a lot of visitors here over the years, and it's just amazing to see kind of the scales falling from people's eyes a lot of times of like, oh, wow, and just connecting things in a way that they hadn't done before. And it's just over and again really dawned on me like, wow, people are lacking this in their daily lives when they're living in urban environments. You know, and I've lived in New York City. I've lived in Dakar. I've lived in Lille, France. I've lived in San Francisco. I've lived in a lot of urban environments, and I like those places. I enjoy living in those places. But I think it's really important that people have a way to be in nature and to be connected with nature, because I really think our human health and our mental health are deeply connected to our connection to nature.
A lot of focus in the book is on the environment, and that's something which I focus on a lot. You know, that was very much what got me into this. And with getting into the environment, I find that there is a lot of overlap with health. And it is very interesting, too, learning about the health benefits of beef. And in your book, there is also a focus on the health side of this question. You make the case that beef and red meat have been unfairly accused of causing health problems. Let's get into that a little bit now.
Yeah, well, I think one of the, again, sort of fascinating things that I uncovered when I was researching was that there was this whole very fascinating history about the science, you know, the sort of dietary health science that I had never really realized was there. I mean, I remember as a child when my parents started to get concerned about studies in news reports saying, you know, that fat is causing a lot of disease, causing heart disease in particular and other things. And I remember my parents, who were very health focused, very interested in eating well and exercise and everything, but they basically decided they weren't going to buy butter anymore, and it was just going to be margarine, you know. And I think, you know, they did a really good job raising us and feeding us, but that was one of those classic mistakes that I think a lot of health conscious people made in that time period. Because I think now there's been a really good reevaluation of a lot of those claims. And when you look at the history of, you know, the medical understanding of these questions, it's very clear that the science was very weak and it was never very strong. But the sort of as time went by, you know, initially there were these kind of epidemiological studies that looked at, you know, populations, and then they looked at consumption, and they said, oh, well, in these areas where you have a lot of this consumption, you have a lot of this disease or whatever. So making really, that's a huge amount of assumptions that need to happen in order to make those kind of conclusions from that kind of research. And then there were, you know, attempts to sort of verify these ideas in clinical trials. And the clinical trials seem to show, you know, things like if you eat more saturated fat, you get a higher level of cholesterol. And if you have a higher level of cholesterol, you end up getting heart disease and so forth. And I think just about everybody believed that after a couple of decades of news reports saying that. But there's actually been, in the last decade especially, a lot of re-examination of that science. In the first Defending Beef, I already went through the history of that and described why sort of more recent studies really do not find a connection between animal fat and heart disease. And actually, even at the time that the idea was originally proposed, there was already the sort of a competing idea out there that the much more likely factor in why industrialized nations were seeing more and more obesity and heart disease and stroke and so forth was about sugar consumption, because the level of sugar consumption was rising pretty dramatically in the 20th century. And so I sort of, you know, go through the history of that and those two competing ideas. And it really wasn't about the science at all that led to the fat, you know, thesis and sort of taking over in terms of the, you know, the acceptance of it. There was a lot more non-scientific stuff that went into the fact that that became the dominant, you know, the fat being the bad thing in the diet being the dominant idea. And nowadays, I think a lot of recent research is actually showing that there's way more complexity to that, that fat has a lot of different kinds of role in the human diet. And I talk about some of the research showing that actually the key issue is whether the fat is oxidized. And basically, fat becomes oxidized in a lot of different ways. But the other element of that is also just the presence of trans fats, you know, and especially artificially created trans fats that were, you know, sort of became ubiquitous in the middle of the 20th century in processed food. And so, you know, we kind of had the wrong culprits, I think, all along. And more, I think the research is tending to show that the processed foods, whether it's, you know, things, you know, the sort of highly processed ingredients of lots of different types, and then specifically also the sweeteners in it that are much more problematic for human health than there's ever been any showing that animal fats are. And in fact, increasingly, I'm convinced that animal fats are a really important and a healthy part of a good, balanced human diet. Because among other things, you know, it helps to make you feel satiated. And so you don't overeat. And we've sort of taken fats and gone from, you know, lard and whole milk and butter, and we've gone towards vegetable oils. There's been a 400% increase in vegetable oil consumption in the American diet in the last few decades, right at the very same time that we've had this rise in obesity and, you know, metabolic diseases. So, you know, the core of the argument to me is, you know, beef has been sort of unfairly, as you said, unfairly accused of health problems. And then on the flip side of it, it's also this incredibly nutrient-rich food and very satiating food that when you eat it, you don't just get nutrition from it, but you also feel fully satiated. You don't feel like you need to eat more food. And so that's another important part of the story, is you don't overeat when you're including beef and other meats in your diet.
Another major change in your second edition is with this, you've talked about your own dietary journey from 33 years as a vegetarian to an omnivore.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to stop eating meat, and why did you return to it?
Well, I kind of mentioned that I was, you know, an environmental kind of activist as a child already, and then got very interested in environmental causes and majored in biology in college. And I really just bought into this argument that if you were a good environmental citizen, you wouldn't be eating meat, especially beef. Beef was the worst, supposedly. And this idea that, you know, I was just talking about with saturated fat being bad, supposedly. And so it just made a lot of sense based on everything I was thinking and hearing and learning about at that time. But when I started working for Bobby Kennedy Jr. as an environmental lawyer on, you know, meat-related issues, I was visiting a lot of places that were producing meat. And, you know, I was going to these large-scale industrial hog facilities, and they were really depressing places. They were like, you know, they looked like very polluting factories, really inhospitable places for humans and animals and, you know, and neighbors. And then on the other hand, I was visiting places like Paul Willis's farm in Iowa, and I was seeing just a lovely place, you know, a place where animals were having good lives and neighbors were living very much in harmony. The neighbors loved Paul's farm because it was a beautiful, wonderful place. And it was fostering wildlife, and it was just beautiful. You know, it was something you'd want to have next door to you. And it was really clicking in my mind that, you know, these were two totally different entities, you know. So I didn't start eating meat at that time, you know, when I was visiting the Nyman Ranch farmers, but I was increasingly convinced that it was not appropriate to vilify, you know, meat production or people raising animals. And then when I married Bill Nyman, you know, to his credit, Bill never pressured me to eat meat at all. But of course, over the years, I've been exposed to really high quality meat. And when we had our children, I wanted them to eat sort of the most nutritious diet possible. And I thought meat was an important part of that. So I've always prepared meat for them. And then my own transition really came when I turned 50, because that was kind of a turning point for me. I wanted to make sure that I was eating a diet that would really allow me to be very healthy as I, you know, went into the second half of my life. And the more I've read, it's really strong connection between a diet that includes meat and being able to maintain muscle mass in particular. And that's really closely connected to bone density as well. So I wanted to make sure I was really healthy going into my, you know, latter years. And I just felt meat is going to help me to do that, to be a healthy, strong person over the next few decades. And that's my goal, you know, without a lot of medications and supplements and everything else, just really having a diet that supports all of my, you know, my body's needs. And so I started eating meat again about almost 2 years ago. And it's been something I'm really happy that I did. I haven't had any problem, my body hasn't had any problem readjusting. And I felt kind of relief, actually, because I had been thinking I should probably be eating meat for quite a while. And I wasn't doing it, you know, partly because just I've been doing the vegetarian diet for so long. And when I started eating meat again, it was kind of like, oh, this is a relief. Now I'm actually following the diet that I think is the best thing for my body. So I've certainly on a, you know, kind of emotional level, it hasn't been difficult. And also physically, it's been great. I'm really enjoying eating the foods again that I didn't eat for so many years.
Wonderful.
I'm really an advocate of omnivory. So the title of your podcast is perfect for me.
Oh, thank you. So you touched upon this earlier about the ethics and how that led to people bring up the environmental case because the ethics part wasn't working. And that, I think that also led to people bringing up the health case of not eating meat. So there's basically what I've heard vegans describe as the three pillars: the ethics, the health, and the environment. Yeah. And most of your book talks about the environment and the health, but I do like that you also talk about the ethics of it, and you argue that there is no sound ethical argument that humans should stop eating meat, which I certainly can agree in part. Tell us a little more about what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, the ethical argument has always been sort of, you know, based on a number of different lines of reasoning. And one of them is that, you know, for example, it's too resource intensive to produce meat, and there just aren't enough, you know, there isn't enough land, and there aren't enough, you know, acres of land to produce food and so forth. So it's, the idea goes that, you know, hunger is basically attributable to the production of meat. So I go through that in quite a bit of detail in the book, and I show how that's really not logically sound, and it's not empirically sound at all. And especially because of, you know, these issues we've been talking about, that when you try to model an ecologically vibrant food system, you really need to have the animals in there. They play a very important role. So it's actually better, you know, in terms of how many people you can feed and with what quality of food, to have the animals than to not have the animals. So that's one component. And then, you know, of course, the other major sort of ethical argument is that, you know, it's just wrong to kill animals for food. And obviously, that's a very individual decision. So when I meet people that are not eating animals because they think it's unethical to do so, I never try to argue against that. You know, I don't try to convert them from an ethical standpoint. But I think that, you know, it's certainly not something that you could argue for all of humanity, because, you know, ethics are things that, you know, culture produces and that are based on our understanding of the world and our history. And our evolution is certainly very closely tied to humans eating animals. You know, we've been doing this for 3 million years. Our physiology is totally based on it. And to me, it's just not sort of sensible to argue that it's unethical for us to do something that our whole body and our, you know, our biology is based on. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't make as an individual choice a decision not to eat animals. I think that's fine if someone wants to do that. I think they're probably depriving themselves of the opportunity to have the nutritionally optimal diet, right? And actually, like I said a minute ago, that's actually what I believe for a long time, you know, that, well, I'm going to not do this, but I know I should probably be, from a nutrition standpoint, should probably be eating meat, but I prefer not to eat animals. But you get to a point, at least I certainly did, where the quality of the food, how much nourishment it provides you, is actually of paramount importance. And for me, the ethics of it should be really more focused on how the animals are raised. Are we treating them with respect throughout their lives? And are we making sure that their slaughtering is done in a way that is free from pain and fear? You know, and if you can do those things, and it is possible to do those things, I believe, and I've seen it and I've been part of it for a long time now. And I think that's our ethical obligation to animals. But just like all plants eat other living things, and all fungi eats other living things, and all animals eats other living things, humans are part of this cycle. And I'm not interested in pulling, you know, humanity out of that natural system and saying, well, we're different from the rest of the natural world. To me, we are part of it. And I think actually understanding that connection with the natural world and our role in it is essential for, you know, sort of having a good life where you feel comfortable with your life and where you're happy, basically. And the anxiety that so many people feel in the modern world today, in my mind, a lot of it is really connected to our disconnection from nature. And I think when we're really connected with nature and thinking about ourselves as a part of nature rather than apart from nature, I think the more peace and joy we're going to feel in our lives.
I know with my blog, as I talk a lot about the environmental and the health aspects, I've also tried to think of how can I make the case for it being ethical to eat meat. It's one which certainly is a harder one to do because with the environment and with health, like you've talked about in defending beef, there is sound data that show why, when done right, it's good for the environment, it's good for your health. Ethics is a more difficult one. And I think, you know, whereas a lot of times there are these three reasons which, when they say ethics, environment, and health, they try to make it sound like it's three separate things. But there's a lot of overlap in them. And especially with ethics, I feel like really the only way to say how it is ethically sound to eat meat is you have to bring in the case of, well, you're helping the environment and you're helping your health. And in that way, I think it is kind of ethical.
Yeah, well, I, you know, this whole ethics question I thought was really, as I'm sure you have, I've read a lot of books and essays about this over the years.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to write a blog for The Atlantic, you know, and I wrote a bunch of different pieces for The Atlantic on food issues. And I did one where I gathered together myself, who was still a vegetarian at the time, but was supporting meat and, you know, meat production, and also two other people. One was Joshua Applestone, who was a founder of a meat company in, but a vegan, former vegan in New York. And then another was Tovar Cerulli, who's an author and who was a vegan for many years. And I, you know, I asked them to write about why they returned to meat eating. And I especially thought, and so that's a really interesting piece that your, you know, your listeners might be interested in looking at, who are, you know, sort of interested in the ethical question. But I really liked Tovar's book that he wrote, which I think is called, if I remember correctly, The Mindful Carnivore. And he writes about how, when he began returning to meat in his diet after many years as a vegan, because he moved from the city into the countryside and had a large garden and used to also gather fruits and vegetables from neighboring farms. And he started to realize that the farms were using a lot of methods to control, you know, various different kinds of pests. you know, whether it was deer or badgers or, you know, gophers or, you know, groundhogs or whatever. And they were killing a lot of these animals. And he himself in his own garden was having to kill a lot of animals in order to protect the garden. And he started realizing, like, wow, this is ridiculous. I'm thinking by not eating animals directly myself that I'm eating an ethical diet. And yet there's a lot of killing happening to produce my fruit and vegetables. And I just thought, he goes through it obviously in a lot of detail in his book, but that's a very interesting perspective to me, that there's, you know, there's these, the killing that we see, and then there's the killing that we don't see. And I think when you eat meat or eggs, it's much more, or fish, you know, whatever, animal-based foods, it's much more obvious to you that there's some death involved in the, you know, getting that food to your plate. And when you look at the strawberries or the kale, it's a lot less obvious. But the truth is that all food production causes injury and death to animals. And for me, that clouds the clarity. You know, I always think it's absurd. I actually have a vegan magazine that I'm a subscriber to because it was given to me one time as a gift. And so I see it every month. And there's this constant phrases like cruelty-free diet or cruelty-free this or cruelty. And it's just, to me, it's just those things are absurd, because there is no production of food without some killing of some type. And so what I'm interested in is the thing that Gabe Brown talks about so well, you know, the farmer in North Dakota who's been such a amazing spokesperson for, you know, truly regenerative farming. And in his book, Dirt to Soil, and I've also met him several times, and he talks so eloquently about this. You know, he says when he was doing conventional farming of just, you know, it was basically corn and soy, but it was just, you know, those plants, but it was conventional farming. He says his whole focus was like killing things. You know, it was always about, how do I kill this weed? How do I kill this insect? How do I kill this other pest? You know? And that when he started transitioning to regenerative farming and step by step made his farm more, much more diverse, much more complex, and much more generative ecologically, his whole focus began to shift from the death to the life. And he has also said that he got more and more health and life in his system the more animals that he added into his farming system. So I think when we talk about the ethics, there's also that whole just massive oversimplification that happens. And when you start looking more deeply, you know, beyond the surface at farming and food systems, you realize the issues are not at all black and white. And so for me, it's about, are we stewarding the earth? Are we stewarding the waters, the soils, the wildlife, all of the things, and the animals that we're raising domestically? And if we're doing that, we're taking respect and care and focusing on the life and the health, as Gabe Brown says, rather than trying to, you know, treat the earth as a factory where we're trying to have inputs and outputs and get the maximum production. That to me is a dead end. And it's also, in my view, unethical kinds of farming production. But if you shift to this other mindset where you think of regeneration and life and the biological health of a system, animals are very important to that. And so to me, that there's nothing unethical about that.
Yes. As we touched upon earlier, I think pretty much everyone can agree the issue of how factory farming, industrialized meat is very unethical. And I think it's great that you have a section of your book devoted to a critique of the beef industry, and you bring up changes that you think should be made. What are some of those?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you know, and I'm really happy to see, just even since I wrote the first book, I think the beef industry is getting far more interested in these questions. You know, it's, you know, just sort of its ecological footprint and what it can do to be better about that. So I think that's one thing I want to just say right up front. But there's still way too much dependence on, you know, things like added hormones to beef cattle. There's a lot of use of that still. There's still antibiotics being fed in feedlots. There's still a lot of feedlots. I mean, I really think I don't completely condemn the use of grain feeding in ruminant systems. I think it makes sense sometimes. But for the most part, I think, you know, grazing animals should be grazing. They should be on grass. And when they're doing that, you know, as we've been talking about, there are all these ecological benefits that come from that, but you also produce much healthier food. You produce food that has more of pretty much everything you want in your food. And there's a lot of intensification that's happened in the beef and dairy systems. And I think we need to undo a lot of that and move back to grass and get rid of the kinds of feeding practices where we're feeding, you know, drugs and chemicals and that sort of thing to beef and dairy cattle. Because these are foods that are incredibly valuable for humans. And, you know, they play an important role in the food system and the ecology of it. But when you have them in, you know, concentrated operations and you're feeding them concentrated feeds, all of that, you know, that benefit of those animals is not there. And you're producing food that's not nearly as good for human health. So, you know, those are, I go through some other specific critiques in the book too. But, you know, basically, I just think we need to have more and more focus in the beef industry on thinking of the potential that these animals provide as, you know, kind of triggers for biological health in a system, and work on improving our grazing. You know, everybody, I mean, even our ranch, we've been obviously focused on this for a very long time, but we're always talking about what we can do to do things better. And I think everyone in agriculture is always trying to, you know, do things better. And I think now that we know that cattle can have this incredibly regenerative and restorative impact on soil health, if the grazing is done well, you know, it's really incumbent on all of us to try to improve our grazing. And for people that are doing things like hormone implantation, I understand the reason people do that. I mean, I actually think that should just be outlawed, because then no one would be able to do it, and then no one would get an economic, you know, disadvantage by not doing it. And that's what Europe did when they started, you know, to outlaw the feeding of antibiotics. They basically wanted to level the playing field for all of the people raising animals. So they said, well, no one could do this anymore. I think that's the kind of stuff that needs to happen. But basically, I think the beef industry is beginning to wake up. And I think that's the good news. And I think more and more movement towards grass and towards focus on cattle as part of regenerative farming is what we need.
I think the beef industry is beginning to open that too. I know, as I've been doing my blog now for over 10 years, and very much as the focus of my blog is on products, I'm seeing a lot more on the market.
Yeah.
You didn't have these when I first started it. So that's a good thing. Yeah. And I think also what it does is it also moves the goalposts further, that at the beginning, it was simply a focus on grass-fed beef, organic, and now we're hearing the term regenerative agriculture. We're looking for that in products, and three organizations have now started certifications for regenerative agriculture.
Right, and I think that stuff is all great. And as you say, the goalposts are always moving, and that's exactly how it should be.
Absolutely.
You know? Because I was talking yesterday to a journalist in Poland who was interviewing me, and she said, wow, there's so much, you know, sort of weird and scary and bad stuff happening in the world, and you seem really optimistic. And she said, how is that? You know, and I said, well, part of my optimism comes from the fact that I've seen such a dramatic shift within agriculture. You know, people are more and more sort of acknowledging the role that food production has in, you know, all of these ecological issues, but particularly climate change, and the potential. You know, there's tremendous potential for agriculture to be making a positive contribution to where the world needs to go on all of this. And so, you know, I think decreasing dependence on chemicals, less concentrated production, more and more focus on soil health and especially soil biology. These things have shifted, as you said, you know, from 10 years ago and from 20 years ago when I first started working on this, a dramatic shift. So I actually feel quite optimistic about the way, you know, where things are going in food production and agriculture. We have a long ways to go, but there's a lot of really good things that are happening and a lot of reason for optimism.
I feel very optimistic, too, and I always like to make an emphasis on optimism, not just talk about how bad everything is and how it needs change, but actually talk about positive steps. That's very much a part of my blog in interviewing people that show how it's being done right. And yeah, the more you do it over the years, when I'm able to have more examples, that's a great sign about how it is moving in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for, as you said, for consumers, there's a lot more choice out there that are good choices. You know, it was really challenging 20 years ago, especially like I was living in New York City when I was working for Waterkeeper for Bobby Kennedy. And it was very difficult at that time in the city to find the kinds of foods I was trying to eat. And now, you know, Walmart and, you know, Safeways and stuff are carrying a lot of really good offerings as far as grass-fed milk, grass-fed meat, pasture-based eggs, you know, and a lot of those claims aren't totally perfect, you know, but I mean, and I encourage people to get out of the supermarket as much as possible, you know, and to buy directly from farmers and to try to find regional, you know, sources of meat and eggs and milk and vegetables and fruits. And there's so much that you can buy right from your region. And I think that's the best way to shop. But there's just way more now. And so from a consumer standpoint, it's an exciting time, I think. And I think we are understanding more and more that when we make that extra effort to get our food directly from farms or other sources, you know, co-ops or places where we're getting things from the farms in our region, we're not just getting food that tastes better, but we're also getting food most of the time, it's something that has more nourishment in it. So it's really worth the effort. And it's often something you can really taste the difference when you're eating it. So it's, I think there's been kind of a real awakening among consumers as well that, hey, this is something that I want to spend my time on, and I want to spend my money on, spend more money on my food. So those are all, you know, more reasons for optimism.
I would recommend too that people buy as much directly from the farmer as they can. And one way that I would recommend for that, because I am a city slicker, I've lived in Los Angeles for over 20 years, and I grew up in Cleveland, so I pretty much lived in the city my entire life. And yes, like while we are seeing more options in supermarkets, a great choice is a farmer's market. A lot of times you have the owner of the farm selling it to you directly there, and you can learn more about it. So I think that's another way to buy from the farmer directly.
Yeah, and also, as you know, it's such a wonderful experience, mm-hmm. because you get to talk directly to the farmer, and there's just pleasure in that. And you get to ask questions, and you get to, often they have pictures of their farm, or you can ask them what you want. And the other thing that's really fun about going to places like farmers markets is you never know what's going to be there.
Yes.
So you go there and you find out, you know, oh, wow, Cape gooseberries or whatever. And it's something a lot of times you've never tried, and you can directly ask them, oh, what do you do with this? And then they'll say, well, I love making Cape gooseberry popsicle, you know, and you go, oh my God, I've never even heard of that, you know, and then you take it home and you try it and it's delicious, you know, and it's a whole different way of thinking about food and thinking about eating. And we have this whole network of people that we work with in our area that are, you know, people that I barter with a lot of times, provide them some of our meat that we raise, and they provide us fish or eggs and things like that. And then even vegetables, I have a number of different bartering arrangements that I've been involved in. And it's just really enriched my life to have those connections with those people and to be getting that food just directly from people so that I know exactly where it came from. And my kids always know where the food is from, and they know the places where the food comes from. And it's just couldn't be more different than going into a fast food restaurant and, you know, getting the food in a couple of seconds. And it's completely anonymous, you know, in terms of what it is, where it comes from, what the ingredients are. And none of us are perfect, right? I think all of it, that's another important thing for people to think about, is like, we're never going to transition everything we eat into a perfect nirvana type state. But it's more about the process, you know, about the journey of like getting to know our food, trying to cook as much as possible, you know, growing food if we have the opportunity to do that. And just making the pleasure of foraging for the food and creating the meals and eating together more central to our daily lives. And that does take time. You know, there's no question that, you know, there are other things that we won't have as much time to do if we do that. But from my experience, it's something that it's really well worth the time. I've had a tremendous amount of enjoyment in the process of making the gathering of the food and the preparation of the food and the sharing of the food the core part of my daily life almost every day.
It does take time, but I think it'd be very enjoyable. For a long time after discovering this, I've done more cooking. And then just recently, like I said, I am a city slicker, but the one thing that was important to me was having property that has a yard where I can grow a garden. And I recently just started that, and it brings me so much pleasure going out to my garden to water it and seeing it grow, yep. Getting to pick it.
Exactly. Totally. I always say, even if you have a little terrace that, you know, where you can grow some pots or something, do it, you know, grow some herbs or whatever, because it's just any connection you can have to, you know, growing something and eating it, it will enhance your life.
It will. So you find the time worth it. And yes, it does take time. That's why there's the term slow food movement.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're just about to wrap, but before we do, what recommendations would you make to listeners who want to make the best of their choices for their diets? And what other things can we do individually to make the food more ecologically and nutritionally sound?
Yeah, well, I think all of us, you know, we're kind of consumers and we're obviously eaters. You know, we buy food, we eat food, and then we're also voters. Hopefully,
yes.
Hopefully as many as possible people are voting, you know, but we're citizens, we're participants in the political process. So I think on the sort of citizen side, all of us can advocate for things, you know, whenever we're in contact with our congressperson or whatever, you know, we can communicate with them that we care about food system issues. I mean, I thought it was really exciting when Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio, who you probably know because
yes.
you're from Ohio originally, was, you know, was making food and health and the connection between farming and health and all that. He was making that kind of a cornerstone of his presidential bid when he was in the primary season. And I just thought that was so exciting to hear those issues being talked about in a presidential campaign. And I feel like, yeah, it was an amazing moment. And I feel like we're kind of beginning to get to that tipping point where this is much more mainstream than it ever was before. And he made an amazing connection between agriculture and health care and, you know, the cost of health care. And I thought that was really quite extraordinary, and I hope that we'll see more of that, you know, in politics. But all of us as citizens can bring that to our own congresspeople whenever we have contact with them and say, you know, I really care about these issues. And, you know, what are you doing as my representative to make sure that the food system is more sustainable and regenerative and humane and all that other stuff? And, you know, just one example of what we could do is there's been, you know, a bill being introduced for years over and over again to basically outlaw the continuous feeding of antibiotics in livestock production. And that was, you know, that kind of law was passed in the European Union, you know, a decade ago. And we still don't have that law here in the U.S. So that's the kind of things that the government can be doing to be helpful. And then on the sort of the consumer and the eater side of it, you know, some of the things we've been talking about going beyond your grocery store and trying to find local sources. And I always suggest to people start with one item that you can really shift, you know, kind of radically from grocery store purchasing to something much better. And I often suggest eggs as a great first place to start. Or even if you're already well on your journey, this is another thing you can transition. If you make an effort to find pasture-based eggs in your community, you will probably be able to find it. And we have, you know, like in our, we live in this little town, you know, north of San Francisco, and we have a bunch of options here. And I have found that having a person that we buy our eggs from directly, we're not only getting really fresh eggs and really delicious eggs, but I know from all, you can just see the difference too when you crack it open. But I know from all my reading how much more nutrition is contained in those eggs. You know, like vitamin E, for example, is more than double in a grass-based egg than an indoor-raised egg that you'd get in a typical grocery store. So, you know, this is something you can do. Just say, okay, I'm going to seek out better eggs. And then when you do that and you start realizing, hey, this costs a little bit more and it takes a little more time to get this, but I enjoy these eggs so much more and it's so much worth it to me to have these, it becomes, you know, just one more step in that journey towards better eating. So I think all of us can make these kinds of steps and not get overwhelmed. You know, you can't change everything you're doing from one day to the next, but you can take steps in the right direction. And it isn't just going to make you I always have to bring it back to this. It isn't just about, you know, the ethics of this are better and the, you know, the environmental impact is better and all those things are important. But for me, bottom line, you enjoy the process of eating more, and the pleasure of a good meal is one of the greatest pleasures in life. So for me, enhancing that experience is going to improve your life every day.
Yes. So I see that there are basically two ways that you can vote. One is at the polling place, and I'm looking for politicians on both sides of the aisle that are about focusing on regenerative agriculture and farming bills. So that's one way of voting. And the other way is vote with your wallet.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly right. Vote with your fork, as I think Wendell Berry has said.
Excellent. So before we go, can you let the listeners know where they can find out more information about what you do and your book?
Yeah, well, we have I'm very active on social media. There's a Defending Beef Facebook page and also a Twitter account, which is just Defending Beef. And I write and speak, and you know, if anyone Googles me, there's a ton of articles that I've written over the years for, you know, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, et cetera. There's a lot of writing that I've done, and then of course, both my books are, or actually three books, all three books now, are available on Amazon, and the new book, the new Defending Beef book, is also available directly from Chelsea Green, the publisher. So I, of course, would urge people to, you know, dive in and read more and just keep going on the journey and keep learning, as I do as well.
I would too. And you talked about the publisher, Chelsea Green. For people wanting to go there, their website is www.chelseagreen.com.
Yep.
Nicolette, it's been a pleasure having you. Thank you for coming on the program.
Well, Aaron, I have really enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of this show are now released every Wednesday. Next week, I interview Blake and Stephanie Alexander of Alexander Family Farms. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, go to iTunes and subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore. You can listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.